Hello and welcome to the What the Flick podcast. It's still called the What the Flick podcast this week. And for the foreseeable future, we are in flux, me and Alonzo.
Anything could happen. We're in exile.
So Alonzo is here. I am here. Matt is in New York. Ben is busy.
I guess. Yes. Elsewhere. Matt is, we can now discuss openly, in New York with his new gig at Movie Phone.
Yeah.
He's running that show.
Yes.
So that'll be exciting.
I don't think I realized that Movie Pass owned Movie Phone.
I did not either until this news came out. I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah, we learned that when our friend got hired by them. So yes. I'm really hoping that Matt will still be able to join us.
Fingers crossed.
We're hoping. So you at least always have me and Alonzo. We are reliable. We are holding down the fort. So we have a really, really jam-packed week. You know, it is September going into October. We've got a big mix of great documentaries and some potentially awards-worthy stuff and some just fun stuff.
Some unusual choices.
Yes. And we're seeing things as we go along now that I know we're going to be in the conversation. You know, I'm seeing A Star Is Born next week.
Yep.
And Wildlife next week.
Do we think?
I don't know. I hear good things. I hear good things.
Okay.
I just saw a movie that I don't know that necessarily will be in the conversation, but it's Bad Times at the El Royale. We'll talk about that next week.
We'll talk about Venom next week, which will not necessarily be in the awards conversation, but will be a thing that people pay attention to.
Unless there's like an MTV Movie Award category for longest tongue. Tom Hardy wins.
If there isn't, I'm sure they're getting on that right now.
They'll find that. But for now, we have some good stuff, including what is supposedly Robert Redford's final performance, if you believe that. He keeps saying that, mm-hmm, in The Old Man and the Gun. Do you want to describe it?
Sure. It's directed by David Lowery, who did the Pete's Dragon remake and A Ghost Story and Ain't Them Body Saints.
It's an early one from him, yes.
And so it stars Robert Redford as Forrest Tucker, not the guy who was on F Troop, but a real-life dude nonetheless, who was a bank robber. And his thing was that he was a very sort of gentlemanly older man who would kind of walk into banks and let people know that he had a gun, but he almost never used it and almost never pointed it at anybody. And, would walk off with relatively small amounts of cash, but almost everyone that the police ever would ask later would say, well, he was very gentlemanly. He was very polite. And so we sort of follow him through his very low-key crime spree, occasionally perpetrated with the help of sidekicks Danny Glover and Tom Waits.
Which is really cool casting. That's a fun combination of people there.
Absolutely. He sparks up a romance with a widowed rancher played by Sissy Spacek. If you are keeping track at home, Redford is 13 years older than her, but they do play like a appropriate age couple on screen.
They didn't give him some like ingenue.
Exactly.
Or like a 40-year-old.
And he is being pursued again in a fairly low-key fashion by a Dallas cop who is played by Casey Affleck, who is married to Tika Sumter, but the interracialness of their relationship is never commented upon in the film, which is a cool thing.
In 1981 in Dallas.
In 1981 in Dallas, exactly. Yeah, you got to figure. That was a bold move, but the movie's sort of, they're fine with it. This is really kind of a character piece. It's interesting because Redford's frequent co-star Paul Newman, you may recall, made one of his last screen appearances in another movie about a real-life bank robber called Where the Money Is, which came out in 2000 with Linda Fiorentino. Not a very good movie, not a very memorable movie, but, Newman was fun in it, and this is a much better film. It's just interesting that both these guys who played a lot of, thieves and charming ne'er-do-wells in the course of their careers, like this is what they choose as their sort of exit, as their swan song.
Right, lovable rogues.
Exactly.
Definitely. There is a great deal of Robert Redford worship here in all of his iconic forms.
Yes.
He is still through and through a movie star. He's aged and he has allowed himself to age gracefully. There's nothing, bizarre going on with science and his face here.
Yes.
But we do see some glimmers of peak Robert Redford, gorgeous, young, virile.
Old pictures, even old film clips.
Film clips, yeah. What movie was that?
The Chase, maybe?
I don't know.
They do that thing like in The Limey where they use an old movie as a flashback.
Old Terrence Stamp, yeah.
Yeah, I don't remember. I'm not sure. I'd have to look that up. But this is a low-key movie. It's very, very much trying to capture a 70s look, in the editing, the font choices.
Yes, from the very first second this movie begins, the opening titles are totally 70s. And there's like a grainy kind of tactile nature to the film.
Yeah, there's even a moment where like a few words in yellow appear at the center of a blue screen. And there's a fuzziness to it that took me back to seeing movies as a child, like in the way that movies don't. Now, do we know if he shot it in digital or on film?
It looks like film. I mean, there appears to be a tangibility to it.
Yeah.
You know, just, and I don't know. Can you fake that now digitally?
Probably.
I don't know.
I mean, look at.
I'll look it up and find it.
Yeah, look at a movie like Grindhouse. You know, where they very much go out of their way to emulate things like scratches and pops and frame missing and stuff, and that was all digital. So
I feel like everything David Lowery has done, though, has hearkened to this era thematically, tonally, just the pacing of his films.
Absolutely, yeah. The Pete's Dragon was very much felt like a kind of 70s kids movie. Was Redford in that, too?
No. Oh, you're right. He did shoot it digitally. Aeroflex.
Okay.
But then the negative is 16 millimeter. What does that mean? I don't know. Anyway.
I guess maybe that they I guess you can dump it from digital to 16 for the editor or something.
But he did shoot it. You're right. So it was fudged that way.
Interesting.
So having said that, though, it's not a total homage to the extreme of a Tarantino film.
No.
You know, it is its own thing. And I also appreciate that it is an old guy and the last vestiges of his criminal self, but it's never anything wacky like we see in a movie like Last Vegas. Or
sure.
What was the one?
Going in Style.
Going in Style. Was that Morgan Freeman?
Yes.
And Alan Arkin? Right. Yeah. So it's never wacky. And maybe part of that is because it is set decades ago. And
sure.
Maybe because it's based on the true story of an actual guy. But there's no, you know, in a movie like this today, you would have jokes about how difficult social media is.
Or Viagra,
newfangled phones and whatever. You don't have any of that. I mean, he's timeless, this gentleman. I mean, he dresses in a very old-fashioned way. He's very courtly. And his whole demeanor is very timeless, even though the film itself is set during a really specific era cinematically.
Yes.
And I love the courtship between him and Sissy Spacek.
Oh, yeah, that's the highlight
lovely
of the film.
Lovely, and it's amorphous, and yet you never doubt the deep affection that they are achieving for each other. I love the way they meet.
Yes.
That's kind of great.
Yeah, no, it's a lovely movie. It is a slight movie.
It is.
You know, and there is a bit of naked awards wrangling here with the whole, I'm retiring, love me now, because, you know, as our friend Scott Vance pointed out, you know, Redford won Oscars for directing and producing Ordinary People, but he's never won for acting.
Do you think that matters to him at this point in his career?
I think it might. I think there's something about this movie seems kind of almost reverse engineered for that effect. I think that ultimately, as much as, you know, I remember making the joke once to a publicist that, you know, when you look at the directors, you know, who've won Oscars and the ones who haven't, like, oh yeah, I said, like, oh yeah, I think I'd rather be on the list with, you know, Kubrick and Hitchcock than Kevin Costner and Mel Gibson. And he said, yeah, but Kubrick and Hitchcock really wanted one. I think everybody wants one.
You're
and
very
so,
cynical.
A little bit, maybe so. But, you know, nonetheless, there are worse performances that have won career retrospective awards, certainly. And Redford is great in this. You know, there was just that IndieWire survey that I unfortunately didn't participate in about what's his best performance. And I still go with All Is Lost. But he's very good in this, and he's very charming, and you're right, he sort of gives you peak Robert Redford, you know, like he's playing the hits here.
There's a twinkle in his eye.
Exactly, yeah.
No, yeah, I had a smile on my face the whole time. You know, it's charming. It is deeply steeped in period detail and vibe, but not like obnoxiously fetishistically so.
Indeed, yeah.
So
it's nice.
Casey Affleck, who is David Lowery's frequent star, is once again in this just doing Casey Affleck.
Yeah.
But there's a scene where when they first encounter each other face to face.
Yes.
It's tense and it's funny. This whole thing feels like a shaggy, low key version of Catch Me If You Can. You know,
yes.
There's like the thrill of
the
chase.
The geriatric version.
Yeah, there's like the thrill of the chase, and that is more important perhaps than actually catching the person you're looking for. I don't know. I enjoyed it though.
Yeah, no, it's perfectly pleasant and never not fun.
Okay, so which number?
I said a 6.
You said 6. Do you like your 6?
I'm going to hold on my
all
six.
All right. Yeah. I'm saying 7.8, so our number is a 6.9. Old Man of the Gun is at 88% on the tomato meter, and I don't know if that is wide this week. It might just be limited this week.
Maybe so, but it's Fox Searchlight, and it is very much, I think, designed to be an award season player. So if
yes.
it's not near you now, it will be soon enough.
Yes. Okay. A movie that will not be in the awards conversation is Smallfoot.
Yes.
Yes.
Well, you never know, frankly.
Shitty
Boss Baby got an
Ferdinand,
Oscar nomination.
Yeah, Shitty Ferdinand got nominated.
Well, Ferdinand wasn't shitty. It just
no,
wasn't special.
It's not deserving of an Oscar nomination.
Agreed.
Nor is Boss Baby.
Definitely not.
But Smallfoot, yeah. This is very surprising to me. This is an animated musical about totalitarianism.
I love the ideas of this movie. You know, it's produced by Requa and Fakara.
Yes.
The guys
and they
behind,
wrote it. They co-wrote it.
They have a story credit.
They are among the many writers credited here. So
the guys behind Bad Santa and I Love You, Philip Morris.
Right. But, so the subversiveness, I suppose, comes from them. Yeah, ideologically, this is a very daring movie, but then I just wish that the execution were more, had more panache to it visually and in terms of the dialogue. So this takes place in a mountaintop village, a secret mountaintop society of Yetis in the Himalayas, and they are hiding there. And their leader is the Stone Keeper, who is voiced by Common. And he literally wears, it's like their Ten Commandments, but it's more like 100 commandments, and he wears them on tiny stones as this giant heavy vestment. And whoever lives in this village, like, you've got to follow the rules. Like, the rules include pretty much, like, don't think for yourself and always follow the rules and try to blend in. And ignorance is bliss. And people know what they know and they don't question anything and they think they're happy. There's a whole opening sequence, which is one of many things that feel like a ripoff of other films, but notably the Lego Movie, where the main Yeti, Mego, voiced by Channing Tatum, he's essentially Emmett in the Lego Movie. And he starts his day with a cheery song about we like live in this way, and the whole town joins him in song, and it's all about how things are totally great as they are, and like don't change and don't question.
Don't rock the boat, yeah.
Yeah, and it's essentially, it's a less catchy version of Everything is Awesome.
Right.
And they think that you begin the day with this giant snail that goes across the sky. And you have to summon it by hitting a giant gong with
your
head, which is his father's job. Migo's his father's job, voiced by Danny DeVito. And they have all these myths that they hold on to and don't dare question.
Yeah, like they have to make ice balls to feed the mammoths, to cool down the mammoths who are holding up the earth. And, you know, yeah. So, I mean, really, one of the, what I was kind of amazed by this movie is that it the message is basically question everything you are told, including religion.
Yeah, question the government, question your leaders, question your beliefs. Yeah,
yes.
I like all that.
And that you're, that more often than not, your leader's motivations may profess to be about public safety, but it's really just about public control.
Right, right. They say they're trying to protect you, but they're actually trying to just have power over you. So one day, Mego dares to wander away.
Well, he accidentally leaves the village when he tries to hit the gong.
Right.
He's trying to train to his dad's job, but he misses the gong and goes over the wall and sees a plane crash and out of it appears a mythical Smallfoot.
Yeah, otherwise known as a human. And so this piques his curiosity, and he dares to go down to the village below, and he sees other small feet, small foots, attorneys general, and feet small. And so the one thing that is clever in this is the way that the Yetis and the Smallfoots perceive each other. Right, because each of them thinks that they're talking in a totally reasonable voice. And, you know, the Yeti is talking just like Channing Tatum being a human being. But the person hears, like, grumbling and growling and, like, intimidating, menacing, you know, noises, while the human thinks he's being calm and controlled in this stressful situation. But the Yeti hears, like, high-pitched kind of squeaking. Yes. And so that's sort of a funny bit. And just, you know, I guess it's sort of a facile notion, like, oh, we aren't so scary after all from these people who seem so other and different, right?
Yeah.
It's a worthwhile message, certainly.
Another message, yes, that, like, tribalism exists just to for the use of governments more than for the good of people.
You know? So the Yetis are afraid of humans, and the humans are afraid of Yetis, but then the Mego Yeti meets the James Corden human, who is this, like, animal planet host whose career is on the skids, and he, you know, meets the Yeti and thinks he's going to rehabilitate his career with this viral footage or whatever, and they come to an understanding. Meanwhile, there's a whole secret group of other Yetis who have been daring to think for themselves in the underground all along,
led by
Zendaya.
Zendaya is Michi, as Twitter likes to say.
And there's a song, go look up Zendaya is Michi. And
that's the one song I liked, actually.
Her song?
Her song. I believe it's called Wonderful Life.
The Wonderful Life song.
Yeah.
But then they do this thing. Yeah, there are several songs in it. They do this really terrible karaoke rap version of Under Pressure, of Queen and David Bowie's Under Pressure. Yeah, there are songs. They burst into song. There's a song off the top that's like Everything is Awesome. So the ideas at the basis of this are quite daring, and I think kids are ready for it. Kids ask a million questions all the time anyway that force us to re-examine our own beliefs. So I think kids are going to respond to this, but we all, no matter what your age is, deserves a film that just has, there's sort of a bland sameness to the look of all the Yetis.
Yeah, the character design is not interesting.
Yeah, various shades of like cream and blue, and they all kind of look the same. There's a LeBron James character, this big shaggy purple Yeti. He's there for comic relief, whatever. Yeah, the songs, the dialogue, a lot of it's very rudimentary, and it doesn't match at all the complicated nature of the premise of the ideas here.
Yeah, I love what this movie is about, but I don't love this movie.
Yeah. Frustrating. So I'm saying a 5.
Yeah, I said 5.5. I hope this, you know, warps a lot of young minds, but there's not much here for adults to take home with them.
Common is everywhere right now. We both just saw The Hate U Give yesterday. The Common's in that, and he's the stone keeper in this, and he is in A Happening of Monumental Proportions, and he's in All About Nina.
Oh, that's right.
Which is really good, which is also out this week. So he made a bunch of movies, and they're all coming out in the next week or so.
I still think he's a little awkward as an actor, but
there's like a stiffness to him. Like, he never blinks.
Mm-hmm.
I keep waiting for Common to blink.
Like, he's less stiff than he was in, say, Just Right, but he's still stiff.
Yes. Anytime Just Right comes up in any form, Chris and I always joke about that one terrible line where he says to Queen Latifah, "You're just right for me."
Ooh. That always reminds me of that old Penn Jillette joke that he had a group that they would go see a movie, and whenever the title was said, like, people would do a golf clap.
Yep. And they say Smallfoot quite a bit in Smallfoot.
That's
so
true.
That counts. Our number's a 5.3. It is at 74% on the tomato meter, which makes it seem like it's a lot better than it actually is. So also coming out this week is Night School, which I saw and Alonzo did not, but I'm guessing you're going to have to play catch up with it.
I might. I mean, that's the thing. Like, you know, it got reviewed for the wrap. So basically, if Dave and I feel like we have to see it for Linoleum Knife, we will. But, you know, that's the beauty of having your own podcast. And sometimes you can be like, I choose not to.
Yes. Does your audience not clamor for your opinion on Night School?
Let them. I don't know. We love Tiffany Haddish, so we might just see it for her. But yeah, everything I'm hearing has been not great. Tell me your take.
So Kevin Hart plays a fast-talking kind of bullshit artist. Stop me if you think you've heard this before. And he is in over his head financially. He's got this girlfriend who's way out of his league, and he's kind of like bullshitted his way into where he is in life. He is like the top salesman at this barbecue company, and he's on the verge of inheriting the whole place when the owner retires and passes it along to him. But he never graduated from high school. He has serious learning disabilities, and we see in a flashback at the beginning to him being in high school, like 20 years earlier, that he just says, screw it, I'm not taking this test, I'm not graduating. And so he needs okay, I'm not going to tell you everything about what happens, but there's a situation that happens where he needs to get a GED. That's all I will say, that for work, he has to get a GED. And so he has to go back to night school. And so there's this cadre of weirdos who are also signed up for night school. But the night school happens to be at the exact same high school that he never graduated from. And the nerd who he bullied is now the principal of the school, who goes out of his way to make his life difficult. And so Tiffany Haddish is the night school teacher. Of course, Kevin Hart and Tiffany Haddish have already had some kind of road rage confrontation where they're just snapping back and forth at each other. And then it turns out, of all the night schools in all the world, she teaches mine.
That's like the moment in every Hallmark movie where the guy and the girl, like, yeah, they have some sort of conflict or argument, and then they run into each other again, and it's you.
Yeah.
You.
This is that, but at night school. And so you have Rob Riggle and Mary Lynn Ricegub and
Romany Malco.
And so they're all there for various reasons. And, you know, it's like the Breakfast Club, but at night. It's the dinner club. They're all there at night, and they're all really different. But they, of course, bond. And it's like, will he get his GED? Will he get his GED before the fiancé finds out he's studying for his GED, which is a really dumb, contrived, like, forced obstacle, you know? Yeah. Like, She's gonna be mad at him for bettering himself.
Yeah.
Right. It's like, you know, on old I Love Lucy episodes where, like, if people just said one tiny thing to each other,
the whole plot would fall apart.
There would be no episode. Right. And so he's having to go through this elaborate ruse to not divulge to her that he's been a fraud about everything he's presented about himself. You know, he gave her a big ring. He drives a Porsche Boxster convertible. So now he doesn't want her to know that he's actually a high school dropout. So it's basically just Tiffany Haddish and Kevin Hart going after each other for 2 hours.
Which in itself is not the worst
idea. Which sounds great, right. and so there, but the writing is not at all up to what either of them can do.
Well, it's like an army of screenwriters, right?
It's like six screenwriters, including Nicholas Stoller.
Hmm.
Yeah, and Malcolm D. Lee directed it. I mean, again, like, who knows who tweaked what, when, where, and how, right? When you have something that's kind of pieced together like that by so many different writers. But, you know, you have the sense that just the two of them improving and, like, riffing on each other would probably be a lot more fun than what they're stuck doing. And then, you know, the supporting players, each of them is in his or her own little box for the entirety of it, and they don't deviate, and they are reliable to be that weird person on cue when the camera goes to them.
Right.
So it's okay. It's okay.
See it on a plane.
Yeah, see it on a plane. When it comes on cable, you know, if you're folding laundry and you're bored, you want to watch something, you know. It's interesting that Kevin Hart and Tiffany Haddish are still kind of playing variations of themselves. Like, she's more of
or themselves in quotes.
Yeah, yeah, their screen persona, right? Yeah. So Kevin Hart is fast talking, and Tiffany Haddish is no nonsense. But, like, they're both, I guess, kind of maturing within those confines. And so, like, she's the night school teacher, so she's not the wild and crazy person, but there's still that edge to her character. There's, like, an unpredictability to her character,
right,
even as she functions as an authority figure here. And he is, you know, trying to pull one over on you, but it's for grown-up reasons. You know, it's not just for fun or for sport. He's also the wild card here, but it's, like, to be a better man for this woman and to get a good job.
Sure.
It's okay. Kind of boring.
Okay.
It's too long. So I'm saying a 4.6.
Oof.
Yeah. I think I would rather watch a 2-hour-long movie of Tiffany Haddish and Kevin Hart, like, having lunch and talking about doing stand-up comedy and their roles in the world. And anyway, so that is that.
Speaking of documentaries about people having lunch and talking about their roles
in the
world. I
set that up
really
nicely. Real fast, Night School is at 27% on the tomato meter. I gave it a 4.6. It's 27%. But the movie we're about to see is at 100%, and it better not deviate from that. And that is Tea with the Dames.
Yes. So this is from director Roger Mitchell, who did Notting Hill. And it is you know, as our friend Matt likes to say, it does what it says on the box. And the box is Dame Maggie Smith, Dame Judi Dench, Dame Eileen Atkins, and Dame Joan Plowright. And they are friends for 60 years, and they're legends in film and theater and television, and they're all dames. And they spend an afternoon at Dame Joan's house, and they talk about life and their careers and their romances and their friendship, and they needle each other and, you know, what it's like to be a woman in the theater or, you know, dealing with movie stuff or whatever. And it's, you know, there's that old, I think, Gene Siskel line about, you know, where he says that this movie is less interesting than a film of this cast having lunch together. You know, it's sort of a truism that film critics often go to with movies about interesting people. And this is sort of like somebody decided, let's make that movie. And it's great. And, you know, it kind of, you know, Dave and I were talking about, did you ever watch Dinner for Five on IFC?
Did Jon Favreau host that?
Yes.
Yes.
And it was like, it would be five show business people, and sometimes they knew each other, sometimes not. And it was this very sort of relaxed and informal conversation about any number of topics, you know, about people in the industry. And it was always really clever and interesting. And, you know, it varied depending on how smart and articulate the guests were, but it was always really interesting. And these four women are so sharp and so smart and have seen so much and done so much and are so comfortable around each other that this movie is just endlessly fascinating.
It could have gone on forever.
Yes.
Yeah, it's only like an hour and a half, maybe.
Oh, yeah, it could be twice the length and still be totally compelling.
Yeah, one thing that was so cool for me, and I'm sure probably for a lot of people who only know Judi Dench, you know, from more recent roles, mm-hmm. only know Maggie Smith as Professor McGonagall,
right.
or whatever.
Or the Dowager Countess from Downton Abbey.
Is not only seeing footage of them from their earlier films and from their early stage work, but like hearing them talk about that and how wild their lives were. I mean, yeah. I think there's the notion that you have some sort of title before your first name and automatically you're supposed to behave in a proper way. And these are proper English ladies. And of course they wouldn't do anything daring or naughty or wrong. And to see a film that embraces these women, and all women, really, in every facet of life and every stage in life. It gets so cool going back and seeing them in their, like, you know, 60s in London phase.
Oh,
know?
Yeah. Like, I think Eileen Atkins and Judi Dench talk about, we swung early.
Yeah.
We didn't need the 60s. You know, like they were like, well, okay, you know. But, yeah, to see, like, baby Maggie Smith opposite, you know, Laurence Olivier in full blackface as Othello.
Yeah, that's cringy.
yeah, or, you know, for that matter, Judi Dench in full green face for A Midsummer Night's Dream, you know, for British TV. It is this kind of reminder of, you know, especially for younger people who do only know them for a specific set of roles. Like, no, they got to those roles after decades and decades of the hard work, and the
right.
movie really kind of captures that stuff. But yeah, I think they're so resilient about a lot of things, and they talk about being mothers, and they talk about, you know, just kind of having to stand up for themselves, and you know what happens when you are, you know, a hardworking actress and a talented actress, but you're not like anybody's traditional idea of like a sex pot, you know, then what do you do with your life? And, you know, do you play Shakespeare's Cleopatra?
Right.
You know?
That was one of my favorite parts in the whole movie, was all of them being self-deprecating, but maybe a little realistic too about how they're perceived. You know, with the four of them, only one of them dared to play Cleopatra, and the others thought, oh, I'm not pretty enough. Like Eileen Atkins was told, you know, you're not traditionally pretty, but you're sexy, you
right.
know, and how they carved careers, really esteemed, impressive careers,
yes.
despite like being put in a certain kind of box.
Right.
Yeah. They're all like survivors. And also I love, they're all really sweet, and like they dote on Joan Plowright. She's the eldest of the four.
Yeah. So she has no eyesight left, or almost none.
It seems like she's very severely visually impaired.
Yeah.
And then they get a little naughty. They're like, oh, we're having champagne now. And Maggie Smith's like, we should have suggested this 2 hours ago. Yeah, Maggie Smith, and just withering dry wit, like lacerating a
yes,
dry wit.
Yes.
And Judi Dench is kind of impish and lovely, and then they're all sweet, doting on Joan Plowright. And
also, like you said about Robert Redford, these are four women who do not look like they have, you
no.
know, altered their looks. They've allowed themselves to age. You know, another film we'll be talking about in the Jane Fonda documentary, she talks about her regrets about plastic surgery, that she loves, you know, Vanessa Redgrave's face now and how she wishes that, you know, that maybe she hadn't gone that route. But yeah, so it's great to see these four women, you know, wrinkles and all, but still like gorgeous and funny and sharp and, you know, just full of insight.
Yeah, they're all in their
80s. Yeah.
Except for Joan Plowright's like 92.
Yeah.
Yes. And yeah, we see her touring around the grounds of the cottage, the country cottage. She shared with Larry.
Yes.
So I'm saying a 9. It was thoroughly enjoyable.
I am also. Did I say?
You said 8.8.
I'll say 9.
Okay, so our number is a 9.
Yeah.
It's at 100% on the tomato meter. And again, like, I'm not sure where this is this week. Trickling out.
I think, yeah, it's branching out there. It's IFC Sundance Select. So, you know, it'll get to you or it'll be streaming soon enough.
Yeah, originally it was called Nothing Like a Dame.
Right.
And now it's
in the UK.
Called Tea with the Dame. So
yes.
Look for it, I suppose, in either of those incarnations. Next up, since we mentioned it, let's talk about the Jane Fonda documentary.
Yes.
This is called Jane Fonda in 5 Acts, and it premiered theatrically last weekend in a few places, but it premiered on HBO on Monday.
Right.
And I'm guessing it's going to be on HBO 1 through 27, in perpetuity.
And
here.
HBO Go and HBO Now. Yeah.
Yeah, so you can find it. This one we know. This can be found.
Yes.
And it is this like bracingly candid confessional from Jane Fonda, looking at her life, as the title suggests, in 5 acts, the first four of which are defined by the men in her life at the various points in time and how she evolved with them, for them,
against
next to them, against them, right? And then eventually comes into her own, you know, now, the Jane Fonda we know now. And it's this really wonderful and beautifully edited collection of, like, everything she has done in her life. And this is a woman who we have seen grow up. She's no secret to us.
Yeah.
And we've seen, you know, she's been famous her entire life, either for acting or for her activism. You either love her or you hate her. And she's very candid now in retrospect about, you know, some decisions that she made that she became infamous for, and, you know, and going to North Vietnam, for example, and how that was perceived. I understand, I've not read her autobiography.
A lot of this sort of overlaps, I would say, with her 2005 memoir, which is great. And
right.
You should totally read it.
I was going to say, I'm guessing a lot of it is also in there. And I understand from reading a couple of reviews that sometimes even just the phrasing is identical. I was moved by how moved she still is in retrospect. And again, like, she's an actress, so maybe she's turning it on for effect, but she's still, like, visibly moved decades later talking about, you know, the mother who committed suicide and how she hopes she was there for her and she wished she could have been there for her more.
Right.
Or talking about the daughter she had with Roger Vadim and how she wished she could have been there for her more. And talking about a scene on Golden Pond with her father, which so much of that is in art imitating life in terms of the tension within their relationship. You know, there's one moment in particular that she goes back to and, you know, she explains what her methodology was in that scene to get a particular emotion. And then she gets teary-eyed talking about that all over again. So her being candid was really what was so striking to me, because she seems like such a force of nature and so powerful and, like, indestructible.
I mean, and even moments where she talks about, like, the first time she saw Vadim or the first time she saw Ted Turner, like, she gets sort of dazzled all over again. You can sort of see in her face, like, whoom, you know, what the impact these dudes had on her, just like from the get-go. And Matt Seitz has an interesting piece, I think, on Vulture, where he says that the movie goes so far to contextualize her in the against these, like you said, the four men and herself. He said, but at the same time, it sort of undoes its own thesis, because, for example, when she starts getting politically active and motivated. She's with Vadim at the time, but he's not the one who's guiding her there. He's sort of like, well, yeah, the U.S. shouldn't be in Vietnam, but he wasn't like super charged about this sort of thing.
That's why she had to find Tom Hayden.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So he basically says like she's more self-motivated than the movie often gives her credit for in the structure of trying to put her against the you know, her father and then her three husbands.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I think, yeah, the movie is very clear about how, you know, she does. She was constantly sort of looking for the approbation that her father never gave her in these men, and how she did sort of change the way she lived because of these men. Whether it was sort of entering into this kind of Euro hedonistic lifestyle with Vadim, the grassroots political stuff with Tom Hayden, where they're like, you know, living, you know, very unglamorously, and, you know, she's doing the dishes and you know, minding the house and you know, that kind of thing. And with Ted Turner, where she all but sort of like leave show business to kind of just be his wife all the time, you know. So there is a case to be made that those relationships do have an impact on her. But yeah, it's a fascinating story. She seems to be very frank about how she's telling it. And, I see the movie, read the book. I just think she's incredible.
Yeah, I was really wowed by it. Yeah, she evolves and kind of gets over each one of them and then has to find the next person who is going to, like, help her define herself in the next stage of her life, to the extent that she even acknowledges that her hair is different with each man. You know, she's got, like, sex kitten, like, Brigitte Bardot looks when she's with Vadim, and then she has what she calls the clute hair, you know, mm-hmm. her much shorter kind of, like, when she's more militant with
right.
Tom Hayden. And then she becomes, like, you know, prim billionaire's wife with just the right haircut for Ted Turner. Yeah, seeing her reunite with Ted Turner and seeing him now was really striking.
I thought he was dead.
I don't think I had thought of him at all.
I just somehow in my mind it had gotten to my head that Ted Turner had died. And so when he popped up, it was like, oh, I guess he's not, you know. Because
yeah.
I grew up in Atlanta, so Ted Turner was like always a very big deal, you know. But yeah, it's they still have such a chemistry, you know, but they talk very frankly about why it didn't work out and why they had to split up. And, you know, and you sort of see that, but you also see like what brought them together in the first place. I mean, you know, he's in the film, Hayden is in the film.
Troy Garrity,
who's her son with Tom Hayden.
Lily Tomlin, Robert Redford. Speaking of Robert Redford.
Yeah, and it's funny because Redford is in the movie, but they kind of diss Redford too. Because Paula Weinstein talks about, who is Jane Fonda's producing partner, talks about how Fonda hits this age where suddenly, like, you're not like a Hollywood, a viable leading lady anymore, and how, you know, they, a few years after The Electric Horseman, for Legal Eagles, instead of her, they turned to Deborah Winger, who was like 25 years younger than him or something. And so I was kind of amazed that they kind of bag on Redford, A, in a movie he's in, and B, I saw this at Sundance.
Oh.
So well,
maybe he, too, at this point in his life, is feeling, you know, candid and introspective or, you know, his choices.
Yeah,
so maybe he's okay with it.
I'm sure he's not mad about it, but it was just kind of interesting to see. But it's always interesting about documentaries about living people, involving living people, like where they're going to go and what they will and won't say. But, yeah, I like this movie very much. And in the book, she talks about, and they touch upon this a little bit in the film, but she talks about her actual vocal pitch, how when you look at her early films, you know, in like Tall Story or Barbarella, she's very much up here.
And her interviews back then too, her voice is much higher back then.
Yeah, and then as she becomes more comfortable in her own skin and as she becomes more sort of self-determined and whatever, she goes into a deeper tone.
The voice we know her to have now is
exactly.
a more powerful place. I like that it's not just this, you know, salacious retelling of all of her exploits politically and personally. It's about how increasingly her ideology drove her artistic choices.
Yeah.
And so you have the China Syndrome and you have 9 to 5.
And Coming Home, yeah.
Right, which a movie, 9 to 5, I've seen a million times, but as a kid it didn't occur to me that, like, this is a groundbreaking thing being driven by women who really do want this for the world. Like, I was 8 when it came out.
Yeah, I mean,
of course it makes sense.
9 to 5 is as messagey as Norma Rae, but it's a comedy, so you don't notice it as much.
Yeah.
But it is very much sort of
dark comedy. Yeah.
It is a dark comedy, but it's making very clear statements about the treatment of women in the workplace. Yeah.
So, yeah, I loved it. The Go Find It, yeah, it's long. It's like 2 hours and 15 minutes
but
long.
But it zips by.
But does not feel like it at all. Yeah, I got kind of teary-eyed watching it. I was sitting on the couch watching it, and Nick's like, what are you watching? Why are you crying? I'm like, it's so sad. It's so sad. Her getting choked up. So I'm saying a 9. I really loved it.
I also said 9.
Our number is 9. It's at 94% on the tomato meter. Next up, we have The Sisters Brothers, which I would love for Alonzo to help me understand.
So this is the English language debut from French filmmaker Jacques Audiard, who did A Prophet and Rust and Bone. And it's based on a novel that I've never read, but whenever I told people that I was seeing the movie, I got a lot of, oh, is that based on the book? I loved that.
So there's an actual book called The Sisters Brothers,
too? There's an actual
too?
Book, yeah. Okay. And people seem to like it in my limited circle, anyway. And so it stars Joaquin Phoenix and John C. Reilly as the Sisters Brothers, and they are kind of hired guns, mainly working for a shadowy figure played by Rutger Hauer. So shadowy that he never speaks in the film.
He's barely in it, yeah.
They are sent off to find Riz Ahmed's character, who has apparently stolen something from Rutger Hauer's character. And also in pursuit of him and also working for Rutger Hauer is Jake Gyllenhaal.
So you have a Nightcrawler reunion.
Exactly. And so Gyllenhaal gets close first and then maybe starts to discover that... that the sequence of events as described to him is maybe not true. And by the time the Sisters Brothers catch up, they have to sort of decide if they're going to work together or clash. Meanwhile, the brothers themselves are kind of in a disagreement. John C. Reilly's character wants to settle down, wants to get, stop having to, like, roam from place to place to kill people, whereas Joaquin Phoenix is perfectly happy doing this and claims that he's the one in charge, although he is an alcoholic, and John C. Reilly is constantly having to sort of take care of him and tend to him and, you know, make sure that things are working out okay. You know, I'm not a giant Western fan. Like, I know that it's part of this complete breakfast, that you can't be a fairly well-rounded film person and completely rule out any genre, particularly Westerns. And so, yeah, there are a handful of ones that I like, but it's not my go-to. It's not one that I'm super steeped in. But I really like this film because, and obviously this is not unprecedented in Westerns. I know a lot of them do this, but it's very much a character piece. And, you know, I think... it unfolds within the world of the Western, but even if you're somebody who doesn't think they like Westerns, I think you'll like this because the characters are so interesting and their interactions are so kind of understated and believable. I think this is one of John C. Reilly's best performances.
It's a rare dramatic role for him.
Yeah, I mean, he gets to touch on his funny and dramatic sides, which he doesn't always get access to both in a role. I think all four of the leads are really terrific, and... you know, I love when a international director makes their American debut and they just really revel in, like, the sky and the trees and all the space. And so I love the way that Odiard and his cinematographer shoot all of this.
I'm looking it up right now, actually.
I think it's funny and it's sad, and I was just really I really had no idea where it was going to go, which I always love in a movie. There's a great scene with Alison Tolman, who plays a saloon girl who John C. Reilly hires to basically, like, talk to him as though she were this woman that he, you know, has been pining for. It's a very smart film, and there's a lot going on, and I really love it. It's one of my favorite movies this year.
Oh, wow. I don't love it that much. Shot by Benoit Deby.
Yes.
Who also shot Spring Breakers.
Ah, okay.
And the Rihanna video for Bitch Better Have My Money. And Enter the Void.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, so very stylish, very singular stuff here. Yeah, there's a very dreamlike element to this film, and increasingly, especially in the final sequence, you don't know what is real and what's
a
dream.
Sure, yeah, yeah, yeah.
The final moments are beautifully fluid, and it's, I won't say where they are, but they're in a house, and the camera goes really seamlessly, like, from one room to the next, and these guys are in one room to the next as the camera is with them, and it's almost like...
it seems too good to be true, and you're left to wonder if it is.
Yeah, is what's really happening here, but it's sort of mesmerizing the way they indicate an evolution within the house, is what I will say. Yeah, it is very languid. It is...
I don't...
with bursts. It's quiet and languid, but then with these bursts of very noisy violence.
Definitely,
I would say, which is a very Western thing to do. Yeah, you're right. This doesn't necessarily have to be a Western to explore the themes and the characters that it does. It could take place in Brooklyn now, or you know, anywhere now. The Western element of it gives it a bit of a life or death kind of tension that increases as the film goes along.
I think it also kind of underscores the idealism. You find out like the Riz Ahmed character sort of wants to start this utopian commune in Dallas, of all places. you know, and it's that notion of the West as a tabula rasa, you know, this sort of untamed territory that anybody can do anything with, you know, whether it's that woman who runs a town all her own that's named after her, or whether it's, you know, Ahmed trying to, like, start this community. You know, this idea of starting over and having, you know, having this clean slate to work from, it kind of reminded me of... In the Master, you know, there's that notion, that sort of very post-war idea of, like, fixing yourself and, you know...
In California.
Yeah, exactly, you know, and fixing your life and starting over. So I think there are some Western elements that are specifically germane to the story.
Right.
But
and the fact that, you know, they're probably doomed, you know, as much as their dreams might be propelling them in a certain direction, you know, there's so much peril. The path there is fraught with peril.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
Which comes from, you know, a life or death kind of situation like these guys see here.
But I saw this at Venice and I was sort of like, I hadn't really heard much about it going in. And it's like, okay, it's a Western. And I know Odiard is an acclaimed filmmaker. I'd never actually seen any of his films. So.
I saw A Prophet.
So I was not really sure what to expect. And by the end of it, I was riveted.
Yeah. The use of fire and the use of like the light coming from fire is quite often very striking.
Yeah. It is darkness too.
Yeah. It is shot very beautifully. It did not grab me emotionally. I appreciate a lot of it technically. Also, I have to admit it's my fourth movie of the day and I saw it very late at night. And so maybe I wasn't in the best ideal mindset for a slow Western takes place at night.
I saw it at 8:30 in the morning and I was fully caffeinated, so maybe that made the difference.
Yeah, I saw it at 9:30 at night in my fourth movie of the night. So I'm saying 6.8.
Okay. All right.
Your number is?
I said 9.5. It's probably going to be on my top 10 list.
Oh, wow. Today. I didn't do math. I forgot to do math.
Oh, that's okay. That's going to be an 8.2.
Okay.
No, sorry. That's wrong.
6.8 plus 9.5.
That's a 16.3. Oh, yeah, 8.2. I was right.
Wow, he is good. So it's at 84% on the tomato meter. And this is one that I would assume is like New York and L.A. this weekend and then trickling out.
Well, yeah, it was New York and L.A. last week.
Oh, that's right. We're
so
playing catch-up with it.
It's making its way around. But, yeah, it'll get to you, I'm sure.
We are playing catch-up with it here. And a movie that probably you shouldn't seek out anywhere in any town that you might live in, and that is yet another version of Little Women.
Yes.
From PureFlix this time.
Yes.
Although it's not that PureFlixy of a PureFlix.
Well, I think they acquired it. It's another faith-based company called Pinnacle Peak produced it. I'm really testing out the pop filter today. Pinnacle Peak Productions. I think it was designed. It's designed to come out in the. It's the 150th anniversary of the publication of the novel in 1868, and they are touting it as the first cinematic modern retelling. Because I guess they're not counting 2012's made for TV, The March Sisters at Christmas.
Do we know when Greta Gerwig's Little Women is set? Next year?
Oh, I believe it's. Period.
Oh, is it okay?
Yeah, she's doing it straight up.
Because I was envisioning her doing it like in Brooklyn, like now.
She could, but my understanding is it's going to be period. But who knows?
This takes place now, but there are some questionable time hops. Anyway, go ahead. Explain Little Women to those of us who have Little Women.
So it's Little Women. It's the four March sisters, and they live with their marmy, and their father is off at war. In this case, he is... you know, he's often Skyping in from whatever battlefield that...
It's like Afghanistan, probably.
Afghanistan. It's never specifically said. And it's four daughters. Beth wants to raise a family. Joe wants to become a famous writer. Meg wants to start a family.
Meg wants a family.
Joe wants to be a writer. Beth is sickly. And little Amy is vain and wants to be an artist. And... You know, it's, they the boy moves in next door who becomes their best friend, and he professes his love to Joe, but she turns him down because she wants to pursue her career, and he winds up marrying Amy.
Spoiler.
Okay, it's a 150-year-old book.
Read a book, people.
Yeah.
Come on.
You know, Beth gets a piano and then dies. You know,
that is like the entirety of her arc.
Basically, yeah. So it's all the kind of story points, you know. But then in a somewhat ham-fisted, faith-based-y kind of way. Like, the March sisters are homeschooled, and when Meg goes to a dance and, like, you know, she drinks a wine cooler and puts on too much makeup and is almost immediately sort of schooled for her foolishness, you know.
But I will say I appreciate that when a boy tries to kiss Meg and she isn't ready for it and he forces himself on her, she's a strong young lady and she gets out of there.
Yes.
And she thinks for herself. And, you know, I think they want to address a little more grown-up themes than you often see in a faith-based film.
This is true.
It's a PG-13
Yeah, and movie. they're working from a strong book, so that obviously helps. The young actress who plays Jo...
Her name is Sarah Davenport.
She has been directed to never be less than forthright all the time, and it gets exhausting. It's like she learned all the wrong things from watching Lauren Graham on Gilmore Girls. Mm. Like, it's so big and pushy, and I'm gonna. It is pitched at a level of intensity and, like, spunk and gumption that just you get sick of really quickly.
And that is Joe. I mean, that is Joe is, you know, forthright and
yeah.
She thinks for herself and she's outspoken and
but not
dramatic.
Not in every single
scene.
Yeah,
yeah. She's very over the top, right?
Yeah.
Leah Thompson is Marmee and she's kind of barely in it.
Yeah, she's fine for the moment she has. I was really annoyed with the mean guy next door, who Grandfather Lawrence, you know, who eventually gives the piano to Beth. In other versions, like he starts out as a very cranky, crusty character, and it's his transformation that, you know, is one of the meaningful sort of story arcs. And in this one, he's just nice from the get-go.
He's barely in it from the get-go.
Yeah.
Michael Flynn plays him. So Lucas Grabeel from High School Musical is Laurie.
Mm-hmm.
And is it me, or is... I thought they were going to make him gay in this. Like, when he tries to kiss Joe, it comes kind of out of nowhere because there's sort of an effeminate kind of BFF, like a gay BFF quality to his demeanor and the way he's playing Laurie.
Yeah. I mean, I always feel uncomfortable talking about this sort of thing, but there is
something
about Lucas Grabeel as an actor that is never convincingly heterosexual.
I mean, I haven't really seen him in a whole lot more, but I'm taking it just from this performance. Like,
yeah.
The way he's playing Laurie,
well, like,
is not like Christian Bale.
Right. I mean, like, he was supposed to be straight in High School Musical movies, ostensibly. But yeah, there is something about him that it's...
He's also like 33 years old.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So this is part of the problem, too, is that there's a bit of time jumping here.
Yeah, they jump back and forth, and they have to play teenagers and adults, and they're not all that great at either.
Yeah, because, like, and again, it's just hair, but, like, Sarah Davenport's hair is exactly the same throughout the entire movie, so you don't know, like, okay, is she still home? Is she living in New York at this point? Is she's come home? Like,
right.
And she looks the same when she's a senior in high school, finding out that she doesn't get into Oxford as she does when 10 years later when she's a writer in New York. And
yeah.
So that took me out a little bit.
Yeah, they don't nail that. I mean, the thing is, like, this is not only is this a well-loved and well-established novel, but it's been filmed quite a few
times.
And pretty well. I mean, from the Cukor version in the 30s to the one in the 40s with, you know, June Allis and Elizabeth Taylor to the extraordinary 1994 Gillian Armstrong version with
Winona Ryder
and Trini Alvarado and Susan Sarandon. So this has a lot to live up to, and this just feels like a lesser version.
Also, what I wonder about it is it's not like other incarnations of Little Women need the Pure Flix take on them. I mean, it's a pretty wholesome story as it is.
It's not like it was racy before.
Right, it's not like it was naughty and we got to do, like, you know, a clean version of Little Women. Like, it is what it is. And I guess the only thing that makes it even vaguely religious is that Beth wears a cross, a very prominently displayed gold cross the whole time. It's okay.
Yeah, they don't, it's not like they run it through the Pure Flix machine and, like, have some, you know, crazy religious epiphanies or, like, some, you know, atheist gets hit by a bus or whatever.
Or get stuck in a tree.
Yeah, you know, it just feels kind of like, what was the point? I mean, I will say this, you know, giving credit where it's due, it is very progressive that this is a version of Little Women that is written, directed, edited, and shot by women.
Right. Claire Niederpruem is your director.
Yes, and she co-wrote it with the woman who edited it, and then another woman was the cinematographer. So it's like, that's great. That's a good step forward, and we don't necessarily think of the faith-based arena as one where, you know, that gives a lot of opportunities to female filmmakers. So that's, I'm glad for all that. That doesn't make the movie any better.
Right. So what's your number?
I give it a 4.5.
Yeah, I'm saying 4.3. So we are at 4.4. It's at 36% on the tomato meter, and it's wide this week.
Yes.
Yeah. You could probably find it near you.
Probably.
If you so choose, or you can stream the Winona Ryder Christian Bale version. Anything else real quick coming out or you want to talk about before we go?
I think that's all I've seen this week.
I should mention really fast, because I'm doing Film Week on KPCC this week, so I've seen a lot.
Oh.
Besides there being Tea with the Dames, besides there being Jane Fonda in Five Acts, there's a Joan Jett documentary that's pretty kick-ass.
Bad Reputation.
Yes, Bad Reputation is what it's called. And she also is very candid about her career and about, you know, the beginning of the Runaways and the falling out of the Runaways and her own career and how, you know, we take Joan Jett for granted because she is a staple. She's just been around for so long. But you realize at that point in time, there were no women playing rock and playing the guitar the way she can back then, you know? And so it's pretty evocative of a time here in L.A., you know, mid-70s, where kids would drive over the hill from the valley and go to these clubs. And, you know, it was kind of around the same time as, like, you know, glam rock. And so you have these kids who are, like, dressing, you know, boys dressing as girls, girls dressing as boys, glitter everywhere. It's a great anecdote about Joan Jett going to London and, like, leaving with glitter and coming back as a punk, you know, and how meeting Johnny Rotten in London really changed her. She hung out with Sid and Nancy and anyway, so it was a fun movie. She's still around. Speaking of people who've had work done, Joan Jett has had work done, but she's really frank about her career, and she's still playing and kicking ass, and it's easy to take for granted how many hits she had. And her longtime producer, something Laguna, I'll have to look it up, but he was like a bubblegum music producer for a long time, and he did like Yummy Yummy Yummy, I Got Love in My Tummy. And what they did was they took that formula, the simplicity of bubblegum rock songs, and just put more of like a rock edge to them.
Guitar on
and
it,
so like, I Hate Myself for Loving You, or I Love Rock and Roll.
Right.
You know, these are all insanely catchy songs. But they rock.
And this movie is opening theatrically, but also streaming. So wherever you are, you can see it.
Yeah. Joan Jett.
In the US anyway.
Yeah. Let me look up what
I want to say Kenny Laguna, is that right?
Maybe.
That name rings a bell.
So, yeah, Billy Joe Armstrong is in it, Iggy Pop, Debbie Harry, Michael J. Fox is in it. Yeah, a lot of people are talking about, right, because she was in Light of Day with him, right. And, Miley Cyrus, Kenny Laguna, very good. But a lot of people talk about Mike Ness from Social Distortion. So they talk about the great influence that she had on all of them. So that
that was one of our big movies at Outfest this summer. I didn't get a chance to see it, but I heard very good things.
They don't talk about her sexuality.
Really?
Really. They talk about how when she sings Crimson and Clover, you know, and she didn't change the pronouns, you know, love her, whatever, you know, she's not changing it to boy. How shocking that seemed for her to be singing about another girl. But they don't in any way, like, explicitly go into her sexuality. And actually, they talk about how she's never married and she's just alone and feels like being a rocker on the road makes it hard to have a family.
Joan.
I mean, is she out?
I thought maybe she was. I thought at some point that finally she had said it, but maybe she
hasn't. But they played this movie at Outfest.
I didn't see it. I didn't program
anyway,
it.
It's really good. It's really good. So, yeah, there's some pretty cool movies this week about like trailblazing badass women.
Yes.
And Joan Jett is one of them. Next week is very busy. Next week mm-hmm. we have Venom.
Yes.
And Bad Times at the El Royale.
And A Star Is Born.
And A Star Is Born. Yes, more importantly. So we will come back and tell you all about all these. I know you went and rewatched all of them in preparation.
I'm in the process now, yeah. I still got to watch What Price Hollywood. And then somebody just reminded me that I need to check out Up Close and Personal.
Oh, that counts?
Apparently.
Even though they're a TV news reporter?
Yeah, but it is based on a true story. But from what I understand, it very much follows the formula. And it's written by Joan Didion and John Gregory Dunn, who wrote the Streisand version in 76. So
okay.
I guess there's some connective tissue there.
All right. Anyway, so we reviewed this week The Old Man and the Gun and Smallfoot and Night School and Tea with the Dames and Joan Fonda in 5 Acts and The Sisters Brothers and Little Women. It's been a busy week, and next week will be as well. But thank you for sticking around with us.
We're hoping to get Matt and Ben back in here at some point.
They exist. We have not stashed them away in the basement somewhere.
Yes.
They're really here. So thank you for sticking around and listening to us. We really, really appreciate it. And we'll see you next week.
Bye.
Bye.